night in the pathless land. But slowly, and with much stumbling, the two hobbits toiled on, hour by hour northward, along the eastern edge of the stony valley. When a grey light crept back over the western heights, long after day had opened in the lands beyond, they went into hiding again and slept a little, turn by turn. In his times of waking, Sam was busy with thoughts of food. At last, when Frodo roused himself and spoke of eating and making ready for yet another effort, he asked the question that was troubling him most. "Begging your pardon, Mr. Frodo," he said, "but have you any notion how far there is still to go?" "No, not any clear notion, Sam," Frodo answered. "In Rivendell, before I set out, I was shown a map of Mordor that was made before the enemy came back here, but I only remember it vaguely. I remember clearest that there was a place in the north where the western range and the northern range send out spurs that nearly meet. That must be 20 leagues at least from the bridge back by the tower. It might be a good point at which to cross. But of course, if we get there, we shall be further than we were from the mountain, 60 miles from it, I should think. I guess that we have gone about 12 leagues north from the bridge now. Even if all goes well, I could hardly reach the mountain in a week. I'm afraid, Sam, that the burden will get very heavy, and I shall go still slower as we get nearer." Sam sighed. "That's just as I feared," he said. "Well, to say nothing of water, we've got to eat less, Mr. Frodo, or else move a bit quicker. At any rate, while we're still in this valley, one more bite, and all the food's ended, save the elves' waybread." "I'll try and be a bit quicker, Sam," said Frodo, drawing a deep breath. "Come on, then. Let's start another march." It was not yet quite dark again. They plodded along, on into the night. The hours passed in a weary stumbling trudge with a few brief halts. At the first hint of grey light under the skirts of the canopy of shadow, they hid themselves again in a dark hollow under an overhanging stone. Slowly the light grew, until it was clearer than it yet had been. A strong wind from the west was now driving the fumes of Mordor from the upper airs. Before long the hobbits could make out the shape of the land for some miles about them. The trough between the mountains and the Morgai had steadily dwindled as it climbed upwards, and the inner ridge was now no more than a shelf in the steep faces of the Efel Duath. But to the east it fell as sheerly as ever down into Gorgoroth. Ahead the watercourse came to an end in broken steps of rock. For out from the main range there sprang a high barren spur, thrusting eastward like a wall. To meet it, there stretched out from the grey and misty northern range of Ered Lithwy a long jutting arm, and between the ends there was a narrow gap, Carach Angren, the Eisenmouth, beyond which lay the deep dale of Udun. In that dale, behind the Morannon, were the tunnels and deep armouries that the servants of Mordor had made for the defence of the black gate of their land. And there now their lord was gathering in haste great forces to meet the onslaught of the captains of the west. Upon the outthrust spurs forts and towers were built, and watchfires burned, and all across the gap an earth wall had been raised, and a deep trench delved that could be crossed only by a single bridge. A few miles north, high up in the angle where the western spur branched away from the main range, stood the old castle of Duathang, now one of the many orc holes that clustered about the gate of Udun. A road, already visible in the growing light, came winding down from it, until only a mile or two from where the hobbits lay, it turned east and ran along a shelf cut in the side of the spur, and so went down into the plain and on to the Eisenmouth. To the hobbits, as they looked out, it seemed that all their journey north had been useless. The plain to their right was dim and smoky, and they could see there neither camps nor troops moving. But all that region was under the vigilance of the forts of Carach Angren. "We've come to a dead end, Sam," said Frodo. "If we go on, we shall only come up to that orc tower. But the only road to take is that road that comes down from it, Unless we go back, we can't climb up westward or climb down eastward.
Then we must take the road, Mr. Frodo, said Sam. We must take it and chance our luck, if there is any luck in Mordor. We might as well give ourselves up as wander about any more, or try to go back. Our food won't last. We've got to make a dash for it.
All right, Sam, said Frodo. Lead me, as long as you've got any hope left.
Mine's gone. But I can't dash, Sam. I'll just plod along after you.
Before you start any more plodding, you need sleep and food, Mr. Frodo. Come and take what you can get of them.
He gave Frodo water and an additional wafer of the whey bread, and he made a pillow of his cloak for his master's head. Frodo was too weary to debate the matter, and Sam didn't tell him that he'd drunk the last drop of their water, and eaten Sam's share of the food as well as his own. When Frodo was asleep, Sam bent over him and listened to his breathing and scanned his face. It was lined and thin, and yet in sleep it looked content and unafraid.
"Well, here goes, master," Sam muttered to himself. "I'll have to leave you for a bit and trust to luck. Water we must have, or we'll get no further."
Sam crept out, and flitting from stone to stone with more than hobbit care, he went down to the watercourse, and then followed it for some way as it climbed north, until he came to the rock steps where, long ago, no doubt, its spring had come gushing down in a little waterfall. All now seemed dry and silent, but refusing to despair, Sam stooped and listened, and to his delight he caught the sound of trickling. Clambering a few steps up, he found a tiny stream of dark water that came out from the hillside and filled a little bare pool, from which again it spilled, and vanished then under the barren stones. Sam tasted the water, and it seemed good enough. Then he drank deeply, refilled the bottle, and turned to go back. At that moment he caught a glimpse of a black form or shadow flitting among the rocks away near Frodo's hiding-place. Biting back a cry, he leapt down from the spring and ran, jumping from stone to stone. It was a wary creature, difficult to see, but Sam had little doubt about it. He longed to get his hands on its neck, but it heard him coming and slipped quickly away. Sam thought he saw a last fleeting glimpse of it, peering back over the edge of the eastward precipice before it ducked and disappeared.
"Well, luck didn't let me down," muttered Sam. "But that was a near thing. Isn't it enough to have orcs by the thousand without that stinking villain coming nosing around? I wish he'd been shot."
He sat down by Frodo and didn't rouse him, but he didn't dare to go to sleep himself. At last, when he felt his eyes closing, and knew that his struggle to keep awake could not go on much longer, he wakened Frodo gently.
"That Gollum's about again, I'm afraid, Mr. Frodo," he said. "Leastways, if it wasn't him, then there's two of him. I went away to find some water and spied him nosing round just as I turned back. I reckon it isn't safe for us both to sleep together, and begging your pardon, but I can't hold up my lids much longer."
"Bless you, Sam," said Frodo. "Lie down and take your proper turn. But I'd rather have Gollum than orcs. At any rate, he won't give us away to them, not unless he's caught himself."
"But he might do a bit of robbery and murder on his own," growled Sam. "Keep your eyes open, Mr. Frodo. There's a bottle full of water. Drink up. We can fill it again when we go on." With that, Sam plunged into sleep. Light was fading when he woke. Frodo sat propped against the rock behind, but he had fallen asleep. The water bottle was empty. There was no sign of Gollum.
Mordor dark had returned, and the watchfires on the heights burned fierce and red when the hobbits set out again on the most dangerous stage of all their journey. They went first to the little spring, and then climbing warily up, they came to the road at the point where it swung east towards the Eisenmouth 20 miles away. It was not a broad road, and it had no wall or parapet along the edge, and as it ran on the sheer drop from its brink became deeper and deeper. The hobbits could hear no movements, and after listening for a while, they set off eastward at a steady pace. After doing some 12 miles, they halted. A short way back the road had bent a little northward, and the stretch that they had passed over was now screened from sight. This proved disastrous. They rested for some minutes, and then went on. But they had not taken many steps when suddenly, in the stillness of the night, they heard the sound that all along they had secretly dreaded, the noise of marching feet. It was still some way behind them, but looking back, they could see the twinkle of torches coming round the bend less than a mile away, and they were moving fast. Too fast for Frodo to escape by flight along the road ahead.
"I feared it, Sam," said Frodo. "We've trusted to luck, and it's failed us. We're trapped."
He looked wildly up at the frowning wall, where the road builders of old had cut the rock sheer for many fathoms above their heads. He ran to the other side and looked over the brink into a dark pit of gloom. "We're trapped at last," he said. He sank to the ground beneath the wall of rock and bowed his head.
"Seems so," said Sam. "Well, we can but wait and see." And with that he sat down beside Frodo under the shadow of the cliff. They didn't have to wait long. The orcs were going at a great pace. Those in the foremost files bore torches. On they came, red flames in the dark, swiftly growing. Now Sam, too, bowed his head, hoping that it would hide his face when the torches reached them, and he set their shields before their knees to hide their feet. "If only they're in a hurry, and will let a couple of tired soldiers alone and pass on," he thought. And so it seemed that they would. The leading orcs came loping along, panting, holding their heads down. They were a gang of the smaller breeds, being driven unwillingly to their Dark Lord's wars. All they cared for was to get the march over and escape the whip. Beside them, running up and down the line, went two of the large, fierce Uruks, cracking lashes and shouting. File after file passed, and the telltale torchlight was already some way ahead. Sam held his breath. Now more than half the line had gone by. Then suddenly one of the slave drivers spied the two figures by the roadside. He flicked a whip at them and yelled,
"Hi, you, get up!"
They didn't answer, and with a shout he halted the whole company.
"Come on, you slugs," he cried. "This is no time for slouching."
He took a step towards them, and even in the gloom he recognized the devices on their shields.
"Deserting, eh?" he snarled. "Or thinking of it? All your folk should have been inside Udoon before yesterday evening, you know that. Up you get and fall in, or I'll have your numbers and report you."
They straggled to their feet, and keeping bent, limping like footsore soldiers, they shuffled back towards the rear of the line.
"No, not at the rear," the slave driver shouted. "Three files up, and stay there, or you'll know it when I come down the line."
He sent his long whiplash cracking over their heads. Then, with another crack and a yell, he started the company off again at a brisk trot. It was hard enough for poor Sam, tired as he was. But for Frodo it was a torment, and soon a nightmare. He set his teeth and tried to stop his mind from thinking, and he struggled on. The stench of the sweating orcs about him was stifling, and he began to gasp with thirst. On they went, and he bent all his will to draw his breath and to make his legs keep going, and yet to what evil end he toiled and endured he did not dare to think. There was no hope of falling out unseen. Now and again the orc driver fell back and jeered at them.
"There now," he laughed, flicking at their legs. "Where there's a whip, there's a will, my slugs. Hold up. I'll give you a nice freshener now. Only you'll get as much lash as your skins will carry when you come in late to your camp. Do you good? Don't you know we're at war?"
They had gone some miles, and the road was at last running down a long slope into the plain, when Frodo's strength began to give out, and his will wavered. He lurched and stumbled. Desperately, Sam tried to help him and hold him up, though he felt that he could himself hardly stay the pace much longer. At any moment now, he knew that the end would come. His master would faint or fall, and all would be discovered, and their bitter efforts be in vain.
"I'll have that big slave-driving devil anyway," he thought.
Then, just as he was putting his hand to the hilt of his sword, there came an unexpected relief. They were out on the plain now, and drawing near the entrance to Udoon. Some way in front of it, before the gate at the bridge end, the road from the west converged with others coming from the south and from Barad-dûr. Along all the roads troops were moving, for the captains of the west were advancing, and the Dark Lord was speeding his forces north. So it chanced that several companies came together at the road meeting in the dark, beyond the light of the watch-fires on the wall. At once there was a great jostling and cursing, as each troop tried to get first to the gate and the ending of their march. Though the drivers yelled and plied their whips, scuffles broke out and some blades were drawn. A troop of heavy-armed Uruks from Barad-dûr charged into the Dûr-Thung line and threw them into confusion. Dazed as he was with pain and weariness, Sam woke up, grasped quickly at his chance, and threw himself to the ground, dragging Frodo down with him. Orcs fell over them, snarling and cursing. Slowly on hand and knee the hobbits crawled away out of the turmoil, until at last, unnoticed, they dropped over the further edge of the road. It had a high curb by which the troop leaders could guide themselves in black night or fog, and it was banked up some feet above the level of the open land. They lay still for a while. It was too dark to seek for cover, if indeed there was any to find. But Sam felt that they ought at least to get further away from the highways and out to the range of torchlight.
"Come on, Mr. Frodo," he whispered. "One more crawl, and then you can lie still."
With a last despairing effort, Frodo raised himself on his hands and struggled on for maybe 20 yards. Then he pitched down into a shallow pit that opened unexpectedly before them, and there he lay like a dead thing.
Chapter 3. Mount Doom. Sam put his ragged orc cloak under his master's head, and covered them both with the grey robe of Lorien, and as he did so his thoughts went out to that fair land, and to the elves, and he hoped that the cloth woven by their hands might have some virtue to keep them hidden beyond all hope in this wilderness of fear. He heard the scuffling and cries die down as the troops passed on through the eyes and mouth. It seemed that in the confusion and the mingling of many companies of various kinds they had not been missed, not yet at any rate. Sam took a sip of water, but pressed Frodo to drink, and when his master had recovered a little, he gave him a whole wafer of their precious whey-bread and made him eat it. Then, too worn out even to feel much fear, they stretched themselves out. They slept a little in uneasy fits, for their sweat grew chill on them, and the hard stones bit them, and they shivered. Out of the north from the Black Gate through Kirith Gorgor there flowed, whispering along the road, a thin, cold air. In the morning a grey light came again, for in the high regions the west wind still blew, but down on the stones behind the fences of the Black Land the air seemed almost dead, chill and yet stifling. Sam looked up out of the hollow. The land all about was dreary, flat and drab-hued. On the roads nearby nothing was moving now, but Sam feared the watchful eyes on the walls of the eyes and mouth, no more than a furlong away northward. South-eastward, far off like a dark standing shadow, loomed the mountain. Smokes were pouring from it, and while those that rose into the upper air trailed away eastward, great rolling clouds floated down its sides and spread over the land. A few miles to the northeast, the foothills of the Ashen Mountains stood like sombre grey ghosts, behind which
The misty northern heights rose like a line of distant cloud, hardly darker than the lowering sky. Sam tried to guess the distances and to decide what way they ought to take. "It looks every step of 50 miles," he muttered gloomily, staring at the threatening mountain. "And that'll take a week if it takes a day with Mr. Frodo as he is." He shook his head, and as he worked things out, slowly a new dark thought grew in his mind. Never for long had hope died in his staunch heart, and always until now he had taken some thought for their return. But the bitter truth came home to him at last. At best their provision would take them to their goal, and when the task was done, there they would come to an end, alone, houseless, foodless, in the midst of a terrible desert. There could be no return. "So that was the job I felt I had to do when I started," thought Sam. "To help Mr. Frodo to the last step and then die with him? Well, if that is the job, then I must do it. But I would dearly like to see Bywater again, and Rosie Cotton and her brothers, and the Gaffer and Marigold and all. I can't think somehow that Gandalf would have sent Mr. Frodo on this errand if there hadn't been any hope of his ever coming back at all. Things all went wrong when he went down in Moria. I wish he hadn't. He would have done something." But even as hope died in Sam, or seemed to die, it was turned to a new strength. Sam's plain hobbit face grew stern, almost grim, as the will hardened in him, and he felt through all his limbs a thrill, as if he was turning into some creature of stone and steel that neither despair nor weariness nor endless barren miles could subdue. With a new sense of responsibility, he brought his eyes back to the ground near at hand, studying the next move. As the light grew a little, he saw to his surprise that what from a distance had seemed wide and featureless flats were in fact all broken and tumbled. Indeed, the whole surface of the plains of Gorgoroth was pocked with great holes, as if, while it was still a waste of soft mud, it had been smitten with a shower of bolts and huge slingstones. The largest of these holes were rimmed with ridges of broken rock, and broad fissures ran out from them in all directions. It was a land in which it would be possible to creep from hiding to hiding, unseen by all but the most watchful eyes. Possible at least for one who was strong and had no need for speed. For the hungry and worn, who had far to go before life failed, it had an evil look. Thinking of all these things, Sam went back to his master. He had no need to rouse him. Frodo was lying on his back with eyes open, staring at the cloudy sky. "Well, Mr. Frodo," said Sam, "I've been having a look round and thinking a bit. There is nothing on the roads, and we'd best be getting away while there's a chance. Can you manage it?"
"I can manage it," said Frodo. "I must."
Once more they started, crawling from hollow to hollow, flitting behind such cover as they could find, but moving always in a slant towards the foothills of the northern range. But as they went, the most easterly of the roads followed them, until it ran off, hugging the skirts of the mountains, away into a wall of black shadow far ahead. Neither man nor orc now moved along its flat grey stretches, for the Dark Lord had almost completed the movement of his forces, and even in the fastness of his own realm he sought the secrecy of night, fearing the winds of the world that had turned against him, tearing aside his veils, and troubled with tidings of bold spies that had passed through his fences. The hobbits had gone a few weary miles when they halted. Frodo seemed nearly spent. Sam saw that he could not go much further in this fashion, crawling, stooping, now picking a doubtful way very slowly, now hurrying at a stumbling run. "I'm going back on to the road while the light lasts, Mr. Frodo," he said. "Trust to luck again. It nearly failed us last time, but it didn't quite.
a steady pace for a few more miles, and then a rest. He was taking a far greater risk than he knew, but Frodo was too much occupied with his burden and with the struggle in his mind to debate, and almost too hopeless to care. They climbed on to the causeway and trudged along, down the hard, cruel road that led to the dark tower itself. But their luck held, and for the rest of that day they met no living or moving thing, and when night fell, they vanished into the darkness of Mordor. All the land now brooded as at the coming of a great storm, for the captains of the West had passed the crossroads and set flames in the deadly fields of Imlad Morgul. So the desperate journey went on, as the ring went south and the banners of the kings rode north. For the hobbits each day, each mile, was more bitter than the one before, as their strength lessened and the land became more evil. They met no enemies by day. At times by night, as they cowered or drowsed uneasily in some hiding beside the road, they heard cries and the noise of many feet, or the swift passing of some cruelly ridden steed. But far worse than all such perils was the ever-approaching threat that beat upon them as they went, the dreadful menace of the power that waited, brooding in deep thought and sleepless malice, behind the dark veils about its throne. Nearer and nearer it drew, looming blacker, like the oncoming of a wall of night at the last end of the world. There came at last a dreadful nightfall, and even as the captains of the West drew near to the end of their living lands, the two wanderers came to an hour of blank despair. 4 days had passed since they had escaped from the orcs, but the time lay behind them like an ever-darkening dream. All this last day Frodo had not spoken, but had walked half-bowed, often stumbling, as if his eyes no longer saw the way before his feet. Sam guessed that among all their pains he bore the worst, the growing weight of the ring, a burden on the body and a torment to his mind. Anxiously Sam had noted how his master's left hand would often be raised as if to ward off a blow, or to screen his shrinking eyes from a dreadful eye that sought to look in them. And sometimes his right hand would creep to his breast, clutching, and then slowly, as the will recovered mastery, it would be withdrawn. Now, as the blackness of night returned, Frodo sat, his head between his knees, his arms hanging wearily to the ground where his hands lay feebly twitching. Sam watched him, till night covered them both and hid them from one another. He could no longer find any words to say, and he turned to his own dark thoughts. As for himself, though weary and under a shadow of fear, he still had some strength left. The Lembas had a virtue, without which they would long ago have lain down to die. It did not satisfy desire, and at times Sam's mind was filled with the memories of food and the longing for simple bread and meats. And yet this waybread of the elves had a potency that increased as travellers relied on it alone and did not mingle it with other foods. It fed the will, and it gave strength to endure, and to master sinew and limb beyond the measure of mortal kind. But now a new decision must be made. They could not follow this road any longer, for it went on eastward into the great shadow. But the mountain now loomed upon their right, almost due south, and they must turn towards it. Yet still before it there stretched a wide region of fuming, barren, ash-ridden land. "Water, water," muttered Sam. He had stinted himself, and in his parched mouth his tongue seemed thick and swollen. But for all his care, they now had very little, perhaps half his bottle, and maybe there were still days to go. All would long ago have been spent, if they had not dared to follow the Orc Road. For at long intervals on that highway, cisterns had been built for the use of troops sent in haste through the waterless regions. In one, Sam had found some water left, stale, muddied by the orcs, but still sufficient for their desperate case. Yet that was now a day ago.
There was no hope of any more. At last, wearied with his cares, Sam drowsed, leaving the morrow till it came. He could do no more. Dream and waking mingled uneasily. He saw lights like gloating eyes, and dark creeping shapes, and he heard noises as of wild beasts, or the dreadful cries of tortured things, and he would start up to find the world all dark and only empty blackness all about him. Once only, as he stood and stared wildly round, did it seem that, though now awake, he could still see pale lights like eyes, but soon they flickered and vanished. The hateful night passed slowly and reluctantly. Such daylight as followed was dim, for here, as the mountain drew near, the air was ever murky, while out from the dark tower there crept the veils of shadow that Sauron wove about himself. Frodo was lying on his back, not moving. Sam stood beside him, reluctant to speak, and yet knowing that the word now lay with him. He must set his master's will to work for another effort. At length, stooping and caressing Frodo's brow, he spoke in his ear. "Wake up, master," he said. "Time for another start." As if roused by a sudden bell, Frodo rose quickly and stood up and looked away southwards. But when his eyes beheld the mountain and the desert, he quailed again. "I can't manage it, Sam," he said. "It's such a weight to carry, such a weight." Sam knew before he spoke that it was vain, and that such words might do more harm than good, but in his pity he could not keep silent. "Then let me carry it a bit for you, master," he said. "You know I would, and gladly, as long as I have any strength." A wild light came into Frodo's eyes. "Stand away! Don't touch me!" he cried. "It is mine, I say. Be off!" His hand strayed to his sword-hilt. But then quickly his voice changed. "No, no, Sam," he said sadly. "But you must understand, it is my burden, and no one else can bear it. It's too late now, Sam dear. You can't help me in that way again. I'm almost in its power now. I could not give it up, and if you tried to take it, I should go mad." Sam nodded. "I understand," he said. "But I've been thinking, Mr. Frodo, there's other things we might do without. Why not lighten the load a bit? We're going that way now, as straight as we can make it." He pointed to the mountain. "It's no good taking anything we're not sure to need." Frodo looked again towards the mountain. "No," he said. "We shan't need much on that road. And at its end, nothing." Picking up his orc shield, he flung it away and threw his helmet after it. Then, pulling off the grey cloak, he undid the heavy belt and let it fall to the ground, and the sheathed sword with it. The threads of the black cloak he tore off and scattered. "There, I'll be an orc no more," he cried, "and I'll bear no weapon, fair or foul. Let them take me if they will." Sam did likewise, and put aside his orc gear, and he took out all the things in his pack. Somehow each of them had become dear to him, if only because he had borne them so far with so much toil. Hardest of all to part with was his cooking gear. Tears welled in his eyes at the thought of casting it away. "Do you remember that bit of rabbit, Mr. Frodo?" he said. "And our place under the warm bank in Captain Faramir's country, the day I saw an Olifant?" "No, I'm afraid not, Sam," said Frodo. "At least I know that such things happened, but I can't see them. No taste of food, no feel of water, no sound of wind, no memory of tree or grass or flower, no image of moon or star are left to me. I'm naked in the dark, Sam, and there's no veil between me and the Wheel of Fire. I begin to see it even with my waking eyes, and all else fades." Sam went to him and kissed his hand. "Then the sooner we're rid of it, the sooner to rest," he said haltingly, finding no better words to say. "Talking won't mend nothing," he muttered to himself, as he gathered up all the things that they had chosen to cast away. He was not willing to leave them lying open in the wilderness for any eyes to see.
Stinker picked up that orc shirt, seemingly, and he isn't going to add a sword to it. His hands are bad enough when empty, and he isn't going to mess with my pans. With that he carried all the gear away to one of the many gaping fissures that scored the land and threw them in. The clatter of his precious pans as they fell down into the dark was like a death knell to his heart. He came back to Frodo, and then, of his elven rope, he cut a short piece to serve his master as a girdle and bind the grey cloak close about his waist. The rest he carefully coiled and put back in his pack. Beside that he kept only the remnants of their whey-bread and the water bottle, and Sting still hanging by his belt. And hidden away in a pocket of his tunic next his breast, the phial of Galadriel, and the little box that she gave him for his own. Now at last they turned their faces to the mountain and set out, thinking no more of concealment, bending their weariness and failing wills only to the one task of going on. In the dimness of its dreary day, few things even in that land of vigilance could have espied them, save from close at hand. Of all the slaves of the Dark Lord, only the Nazgul could have warned him of the peril that crept, small but indomitable, into the very heart of his guarded realm. But the Nazgul and their black wings were abroad on another errand. They were gathered far away, shadowing the march of the captains of the West, and thither the thought of the Dark Tower was turned. That day it seemed to Sam that his master had found some new strength, more than could be explained by the small lightening of the load that he had to carry. In the first marches, they went further and faster than he had hoped. The land was rough and hostile, and yet they made much progress, and even the mountain drew nearer. But as the day wore on, and all too soon the dim light began to fail, Frodo stooped again and began to stagger, as if the renewed effort had squandered his remaining strength. At their last halt he sank down and said, "I'm thirsty, Sam," and didn't speak again. Sam gave him a mouthful of water. Only one more mouthful remained. He went without himself. And now, as once more the night of Mordor closed over him, through all his thoughts there came the memory of water, and every brook or stream or fount that he had ever seen, under green willow shades or twinkling in the sun, danced and rippled for his torment behind the blindness of his eyes. He felt the cool mud about his toes as he paddled in the pool at Bywater with Jolly Cotton and Tom and Nibs and their sister Rosie. "But that was years ago," he sighed, "and far away. The way back, if there is one, goes past the mountain." He couldn't sleep, and he held a debate with himself. "Well, come now. We've done better than you hoped," he said sturdily. "Begun well, anyway. I reckon we crossed half the distance before we stopped. One more day will do it." And then he paused. "Don't be a fool, Sam Gamgee," came an answer in his own voice. "He won't go another day like that if he moves at all, and you can't go on much longer giving him all the water and most of the food." "I can go on a good way, though, and I will." "Where to?" "To the mountain, of course." "But what then, Sam Gamgee? What then? When you get there, what are you going to do? He won't be able to do anything for himself." To his dismay, Sam realized that he had not got an answer to this. He had no clear idea at all. Frodo had not spoken much to him of his errand, and Sam only knew vaguely that the ring had somehow to be put into the fire. "The Cracks of Doom," he muttered, the old name rising to his mind. "Well, if Master knows how to find them, I don't." "There you are," came the answer. "It's all quite useless." He said so himself. "You're the fool going on hoping and toiling. You could have lain down and gone to sleep together days ago if you hadn't been so dogged. But you'll die just the same, or worse. You might just as well lie down now and give it up. You'll never get to the top anyway."
"I'll get there, if I leave everything but my bones behind,"
said Sam, "and I'll carry Mr. Frodo up myself if it breaks my back and heart. So stop arguing."
At that moment Sam felt a tremor in the ground beneath him, and he heard or sensed a deep remote rumble as of thunder imprisoned under the earth. There was a brief red flame that flickered under the clouds and died away. The mountain, too, slept uneasily. The last stage of their journey to Orodruin came, and it was a torment greater than Sam had ever thought that he could bear. He was in pain, and so parched that he could no longer swallow even a mouthful of food. It remained dark, not only because of the smokes of the mountain. There seemed to be a storm coming up, and away to the southeast there was a shimmer of lightnings under the black skies. Worst of all, the air was full of fumes. Breathing was painful and difficult, and a dizziness came on them, so that they staggered and often fell. And yet their wills did not yield, and they struggled on. The mountain crept up ever nearer, until, if they lifted their heavy heads, it filled all their sight, looming vast before them, a huge mass of ash and slag and burned stone, out of which a sheer-sided cone was raised into the clouds. Before the day-long dusk ended and true night came again, they had crawled and stumbled to its very feet. With a gasp, Frodo cast himself on the ground. Sam sat by him. To his surprise, he felt tired but lighter, and his head seemed clear again. No more debates disturbed his mind. He knew all the arguments of despair and would not listen to them. His will was set, and only death would break it. He felt no longer either desire or need of sleep, but rather of watchfulness. He knew that all the hazards and perils were now drawing together to a point. The next day would be a day of doom, the day of final effort or disaster, the last gasp. But when would it come? The night seemed endless and timeless, minute after minute falling dead and adding up to no passing hour, bringing no change. Sam began to wonder if a second darkness had begun, and no day would ever reappear. At last he groped for Frodo's hand. It was cold and trembling. His master was shivering. "I didn't ought to have left my blanket behind," muttered Sam, and lying down he tried to comfort Frodo with his arms and body. Then sleep took him, and the dim light of the last day of their quest found them side by side. The wind had fallen the day before, as it shifted from the west, and now it came from the north and began to rise, and slowly the light of the unseen sun filtered down into the shadows where the hobbits lay. "Now for it, now for the last gasp," said Sam as he struggled to his feet. He bent over Frodo, rousing him gently. Frodo groaned, but with a great effort of will he staggered up, and then he fell upon his knees again. He raised his eyes with difficulty to the dark slopes of Mount Doom towering above him, and then pitifully he began to crawl forward on his hands. Sam looked at him and wept in his heart, but no tears came to his dry and stinging eyes. "I said I'd carry him if it broke my back," he muttered, "and I will." "Come, Mr. Frodo," he cried, "I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you and it as well. So up you get. Come on, Mr. Frodo, dear. Sam will give you a ride. Just tell him where to go, and he'll go." As Frodo clung upon his back, arms loosely about his neck, legs clasped firmly under his arms, Sam staggered to his feet, and then, to his amazement, he felt the burden light. He'd feared that he would have barely strength to lift his master alone, and beyond that he had expected to share in the dreadful dragging weight of the accursed ring. But it was not so. Whether because Frodo was so worn by his long pains, wound of knife, and venomous sting, and sorrow, fear, and homeless wandering, or because some gift of final strength was given to him, Sam lifted Frodo with no more difficulty than if he were carrying a hobbit child pick-a-back in some romp on the lawns or hayfields of the Shire. He took a deep breath and started off. They'd reached the mountain's foot on its northern side, and a little to the westward.
There its long grey slopes, though broken, were not sheer. Frodo didn't speak, and so Sam struggled on as best he could, having no guidance but the will to climb as high as might be before his strength gave out and his will broke. On he toiled, up and up, turning this way and that to lessen the slope, often stumbling forward, and at the last crawling like a snail with a heavy burden on its back. When his will could drive him no further, and his limbs gave way, he stopped and laid his master gently down. Frodo opened his eyes and drew a breath. It was easier to breathe up here, above the reeks that coiled and drifted down below.
"Thank you, Sam," he said in a cracked whisper. "How far is there to go?"
"I don't know," said Sam, "because I don't know where we're going." He looked back, and then he looked up, and he was amazed to see how far his last effort had brought him. The mountain, standing ominous and alone, had looked taller than it was. Sam saw now that it was less lofty than the high passes of the Efel Duith, which he and Frodo had scaled. The confused and tumbled shoulders of its great base rose for maybe 3,000 feet above the plains, and above them was reared half as high again its tall central cone, like a vast oast or chimney capped with a jagged crater. But already Sam was more than halfway up the base, and the plain of Gorgoroth was dim below him, wrapped in fume and shadow. As he looked up, he would have given a shout if his parched throat had allowed him, for amid the rugged humps and shoulders above him he saw plainly a path or road. It climbed like a rising girdle from the west and wound snake-like about the mountain, until before it went round out of view it reached the foot of the cone upon its eastern side. Sam could not see the course immediately above him, where it was lowest, for a steep slope went up from where he stood, but he guessed that if he could only struggle on just a little way further up, they would strike this path. A gleam of hope returned to him. They might conquer the mountain yet. "Why, it might have been put there a purpose," he said to himself. "If it wasn't there, I'd have to say I was beaten in the end." The path was not put there for the purposes of Sam. He didn't know it, but he was looking at Sauron's road from Barad-dûr to the Samarth-nar, the Chambers of Fire. Out from the Dark Tower's huge western gate it came, over a deep abyss, by a vast bridge of iron, and then, passing into the plain, it ran for a league between two smoking chasms, and so reached a long sloping causeway that led up on to the mountain's eastern side. Thence, turning and encircling all its wide girth from south to north, it climbed at last, high in the upper cone, but still far from the reeking summit, to a dark entrance that gazed back east, straight to the window of the eye in Sauron's shadow-mantled fortress. Often blocked or destroyed by the tumults of the mountain's furnaces, always that road was repaired and cleaned again by the labours of countless orcs. Sam drew a deep breath. There was a path, but how he was to get up the slope to it he did not know. First he must ease his aching back. He lay flat beside Frodo for a while. Neither spoke. Slowly the light grew. Suddenly a sense of urgency, which he didn't understand, came to Sam. It was almost as if he had been called. Now, or it'll be too late. He braced himself and got up. Frodo also seemed to have felt the call. He struggled to his knees. "I'll crawl, Sam," he gasped. So foot by foot, like small grey insects, they crept up the slope. They came to the path and found that it was broad, paved with broken rubble and beaten ash. Frodo clambered onto it, and then moved as if by some compulsion, he turned slowly to face the east. Far off the shadows of Sauron hung, but torn by some gust of wind out of the world, or else moved by some great disquiet within, the mantling cloud swirled, and for a moment drew aside, and then he saw, rising black, blacker and darker than the vast shades amid which it stood, the cruel pinnacles and iron crown of the topmost tower of Barad-dûr.
One moment only it stared out, but as from some great window immeasurably high there stabbed northward a flame of red, the flicker of a piercing eye, and then the shadows were furled again, and the terrible vision was removed. The eye was not turned to them. It was gazing north, to where the captains of the west stood at bay, and thither all its malice was now bent, as the power moved to strike its deadly blow. But Frodo, at that dreadful glimpse, fell as one stricken mortally. His hand sought the chain about his neck. Sam knelt by him. Faint, almost inaudibly, he heard Frodo whispering, "Help me, Sam. Help me, Sam. Hold my hand. I can't stop it." Sam took his master's hands and laid them together, palm to palm, and kissed them. And then he held them gently between his own. The thought came suddenly to him. "He's spotted us. It's all up, or it soon will be. Now, Sam Gamgee, this is the end of ends." Again he lifted Frodo and drew his hands down to his own breast, letting his master's legs dangle. Then he bowed his head and struggled off along the climbing road. It was not as easy a way to take as it had looked at first. By fortune the fires that had poured forth in the great turmoils when Sam stood upon Kirithungol had flowed down mainly on the southern and western slopes, and the road on this side was not blocked. Yet in many places it had crumbled away, or was crossed by gaping rents. After climbing eastward for some time, it bent back upon itself at a sharp angle, and went westward for a space. There at the bend it was cut deep through a crag of old weathered stone once long ago vomited from the mountain's furnaces. Panting under his load, Sam turned the bend, and even as he did so, out of the corner of his eye he had a glimpse of something falling from the crag like a small piece of black stone that had toppled off as he passed. A sudden weight smote him, and he crashed forward, tearing the backs of his hands that still clasped his master's. Then he knew what had happened, for above him, as he lay, he heard a hated voice.
"Wicked master!" it hissed. "Wicked master cheats us! Cheats Smeagol! He mustn't go that way! He mustn't hurt Precious! Give it to Smeagol! Yes, give it to us! Give it to us!"
With a violent heave Sam rose up. At once he drew his sword, but he could do nothing. Gollum and Frodo were locked together. Gollum was tearing at his master, trying to get at the chain and the ring. This was probably the only thing that could have roused the dying embers of Frodo's heart and will. An attack, an attempt to wrest his treasure from him by force. He fought back with a sudden fury that amazed Sam, and Gollum also. Even so, things might have gone far otherwise, if Gollum himself had remained unchanged. But whatever dreadful paths, lonely and hungry and waterless, he had trodden, driven by a devouring desire and a terrible fear, they had left grievous marks on him. He was a lean, starved, haggard thing, all bones and tight-drawn sallow skin. A wild light flamed in his eyes, but his malice was no longer matched by his old griping strength. Frodo flung him off and rose up quivering.
"Down, down!"
he gasped, clutching his hand to his breast, so that beneath the cover of his leather shirt he clasped the ring.
"Down, you creeping thing, and out of my path! Your time is at an end. You cannot betray me or slay me now!"
Then suddenly, as before under the eaves of the Emin Wheel, Sam saw these two rivals with other vision. A crouching shape, scarcely more than the shadow of a living thing, a creature now wholly ruined and defeated, yet filled with a hideous lust and rage, and before it stood stern, untouchable now by pity, a figure robed in white, but at its breast it held a wheel of fire. Out of the fire there spoke a commanding voice.
"Begone, and trouble me no more. If you touch me ever again, you shall be cast yourself into the fire of doom."
The crouching shape backed away, terror in its blinking eyes, and yet at the same time insatiable desire. Then the vision passed, and Sam saw Frodo standing, hand on breast, his breath coming in great gasps, and Gollum at his feet, resting on his knees with his wide splayed hands upon the ground.
"Look out!" cried Sam. "He'll spring!"
He stepped forward, brandishing his sword.
"Quick, master!" he gasped. "Go on! Go on! No time to lose! I'll deal with him! Go on!"
Frodo looked at him as if at one now far away. "Yes, I must go on," he said. "Farewell, Sam. This is the end at last. On Mount Doom, Doom shall fall. Farewell." He turned and went on, walking slowly but erect up the climbing path.
"Now," said Sam, "at last I can deal with you."
He leapt forward with drawn blade, ready for battle. But Gollum did not spring. He fell flat upon the ground and whimpered.
"Don't kill us," he wept. "Don't hurt us with nasty, cruel steel. Let us live, yes, live just a little longer. Lost, lost, we're lost. And when Precious goes, we'll die, yes, die into the dust."
He clawed up the ashes of the path with his long, fleshless fingers.
"Dust," he hissed.
Sam's hand wavered. His mind was hot with wrath and the memory of evil. It would be just to slay this treacherous, murderous creature, just and many times deserved, and also it seemed the only safe thing to do. But deep in his heart there was something that restrained him. He couldn't strike this thing lying in the dust, forlorn, ruinous, utterly wretched. He himself, though only for a little while, had borne the ring, and now dimly he guessed the agony of Gollum's shrivelled mind and body, enslaved to that ring, unable to find peace or relief ever in life again. But Sam had no words to express what he felt.
"Oh, curse you, you stinking thing," he said. "Go away, be off. I don't trust you, not as far as I could kick you. But be off, or I shall hurt you, yes, with nasty, cruel steel."
Gollum got up on all fours and backed away for several paces, and then he turned, and as Sam aimed a kick at him, he fled away down the path. Sam gave no more heed to him. He suddenly remembered his master. He looked up the path and could not see him. As fast as he could, he trudged up the road. If he had looked back, he might have seen, not far below, Gollum turn again, and then, with a wild light of madness glaring in his eyes, come, swiftly but warily, creeping on behind, a slinking shadow among the stones. The path climbed on. Soon it bent again, and with a last eastward course, passed in a cutting along the face of the cone, and came to the dark door in the mountain side, the door of the Samarthnaar. The way now rising towards the south, the sun, piercing the smokes and haze, burned ominous, a dull, bleared disk of red. But all Mordor lay about the mountain like a dead land, silent, shadow-folded, waiting for some dreadful stroke. Sam came to the gaping mouth and peered in. It was dark and hot, and a deep rumbling shook the air.
"Frodo! Master!" he called.
There was no answer. For a moment he stood, his heart beating with wild fears, and then he plunged in. A shadow followed him. At first he could see nothing. In his great need he drew out once more the phial of Galadriel, but it was pale and cold in his trembling hand, and threw no light into that stifling dark. He was come to the heart of the realm of Sauron, and the forges of his ancient might, greatest in Middle-earth. All other powers were here subdued. Fearfully he took a few uncertain steps in the dark, and then all at once there came a flash of red that leapt upwards and smote the high black roof. Then Sam saw that he was in a long cave or tunnel that bored into the mountain's smoking cone. But only a short way ahead, its floor and the walls on either side were cloven by a great fissure, out of which the red glare came, now leaping up, now dying down into darkness. And all the while, far below, there was a rumour and a trouble as of great engines throbbing and labouring. The light sprang up again, and there, on the brink of the chasm, at the very crack of doom, stood Frodo, black against the glare, tense, erect,